Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In days of yore, you know, only a couple of months ago, when we actually left the house, we would go through the same motions. Wake up, go to work, sit in front of a screen, call it a day, head home, sit in front of a screen, and watch more work. But not just any work.
Dunder Mifflin, this is Pam.
15 years ago this March, we were introduced to the staff of Dunder Mifflin Paper Company's Scranton, Pennsylvania branch, where a film crew is documenting an American workplace.
My job is to speak to clients on the phone about quantities and type of copier paper. You know, whether we can supply it to them, whether they can pay for it. And I'm boring myself just talking about this.
Overseeing it all with his world's best boss coffee mug was the one and only Michael Scott.
I think the main difference between me and Donald Trump is that I get no pleasure out of saying the words, "You're fired. You're fired. Oh, you're fired." He just makes people sad, and an office can't function that way. No way.
"You're fired."
I think if I had a catchphrase, it would be, "You're hired, and you can work here as long as you want."
It's been a while since the office closed up shop, but it's still going strong. You could say it's more popular now than it has ever been. It's one of the most watched, if not the most watched, show on Netflix. Rolling Stone senior writer Andy Green set out to get the story behind this British-imported mockumentary-turned-cultural powerhouse, and the result was his latest book, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. In another sign of the show's enduring popularity, the book quickly became a New York Times bestseller, and not long after its publication, Andy Green joined us. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Sure, and thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So tell me, what makes The Office the greatest sitcom of the 2000s?
Well, I think partially it's just so well written, it's so funny, and there's not much competition. I think that peak TV has produced so many great dramas and thrillers and docuseries and so many great kinds of shows, but very few great sitcoms. It's a medium that hasn't evolved much, and The Office was such a huge leap forward. It changed so many things that it just changed the game in so many ways.
We'll talk about what it did to change all those things, but why did you want to write about it? Because I think this started, if I'm not mistaken, as an article that you wrote for Rolling Stone, and then it just ballooned from that, right?
Yeah, I watched an episode I love, which is The Dinner Party. Mm-hmm. And the 10-year anniversary was coming up, so I decided as a lark just to do a oral history of that one episode, which is a classic. It's just completely just brilliant. And I spoke with John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer and Ed Helms and so much of the cast and the writers and the director, it was Paul Feig, and I had so much fun doing it. And the story of that one episode was so rich, and it was a huge hit on our website. I went on Amazon.com, searched The Office, saw no other book about it, and I was like, hey, I can do that. And so it just sort of snowballed.
I can't believe that there may be listeners out there who have never seen The Office, but there may be listeners out there, just in case. What's the premise? If I didn't set it up in the opening, what's the premise?
It's the most mundane premise you could possibly think of for a sitcom. It's the day-to-day lives of employees at a struggling paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's the premise. And it's seen through the eyes of an unseen documentary crew, which for some reason they've decided to spend 9 seasons or to spend 9 years just filming people who are trying to sell paper, which sounds so painfully boring. But yet, it's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They never tell the audience that the documentary crew is there. It's just there from the start, right?
It's there from the start. Right. They acknowledge the cameras and say, mm-hmm. and some characters look at the cameras, and you occasionally see them. they turn their microphones off or something. It's not till season 9, the very end, when you finally see the filmmakers.
Did they do it with one camera or did they do it with multiple handheld cameras? Do you know?
It's a weird thing because they call it a single camera show, but there are always two cameras going.
Right.
It was two cameramen who were named Randall and Matt who worked on Survivor. And they shot The Office the same way they shot Survivor, which is sort of interesting.
The show started in Britain, for people who don't know, with Ricky Gervais in front of and behind the camera, along with Steve Merchant, who's also had his own TV show, and I think it was on HBO for a short amount of time. They both wrote and directed those episodes, and Stephen Merchant is very funny on his own. Interviewed both of them for this book. Where did they get the idea, and why did they decide to produce this sitcom in Britain? And Britain has a little different take on comedy, but why did they decide to shoot it like a mockumentary?
Well, at the time in the UK, there were all of these new sorts of reality shows where they'd show people working at an airport or a factory. There was just the mundane lives of people became fodder for TV over there, which was before it came to the States, really. And they loved these shows, but they sort of wanted to put a spin on them. And they both worked in actual offices. And they were bored at work, and they sort of found the dynamics of an office to be untapped for comedy. You know, it's a sort of unnatural environment where you spend all day alongside people that you don't really like, but you're forced to sort of coexist with them. Mm-hmm. And they saw just so much comedy in that. And Ricky Gervais thought of this boss-like character, of a boss character, who wants to be famous but has no real talent, but sees a sort of reality show about his office as a means to become famous. So he's always playing to the camera as he's trying to do his job, and he's failing at both things at all times. They just thought it was so funny.
And that's one of the differences, I think. I've never really seen more than just little clips of the British version, but the difference, I think, in the lead character, whose name is Michael Scott in America, but it's Brent...
It's David Brent, yeah.
David Brent in the British version. The difference is that David Brent wants to be famous. Michael Scott wants to be loved.
Yeah, and that's a crucial distinction. And so in the UK, they have a long history of protagonist on their shows being very unlikable. And that doesn't really transfer across the Atlantic. So David Brent is really gruff. He's cruel. He's cruel to his staff. He has no real redeeming qualities, and that's funny. But there's just 12 episodes of UK Office. It was two seasons of six each, so you wouldn't really have time to get sick of that character. Hmm. In the US version, when they're doing 24 a year, they had to change the character around in some pretty big ways to make it work.
When Americans adopt British TV shows, and they often do for whatever reason, they often water them down and take the punch out of it. That's a good example because Ricky Gervais' character was mean and cruel to his staff. Michael is not. He can hurt them inadvertently, but it's always inadvertent.
Yes.
But I don't think that the watering down happened in this version of the show. Which version is better? Do you have an opinion on that?
I like the American version. I mean, I love what Ricky Gervais did, what Steven did, but there's something about watching a show where the central character is so unlikable and so grating, it's hard to really care about him. So, and there's just 12 of them. It's just a little tiny show. I mean, it's funny and groundbreaking, but the US show is so much more nuanced and so much more layered.
Yeah.
And the characters are more lovable. I prefer the US one.
I mean, given the fact that they're both set in an office, it's kind of hard, I suppose, to change up the look of the set. But it actually surprised me how many similarities there are to if you just turn a freeze frame of the British version, you know it's The Office. It's just that the receptionist desk is on the wrong side of the room, like they drive on the wrong side of the road. But everybody's seated in about the same configuration. All of the characters play similar roles, although they're named different things, and yet each version is unique. Did the writers, when they adopted that layout, did they also adopt some of the pranks and some of the plot lines of the British series, at least initially?
Yeah, and the pilot of the US version is a shot-for-shot remake at times of the UK office pilot, which was a huge mistake that they all live to regret deeply because the critics just tore it to shreds. And the scenes in which Steve Carell's Michael Scott character is basically he's a clone of Gervais at times, and he's really abrasive and very unlikable in the pilot. But it's the same pranks, it's the same stapler in the Jello. It's a remake.
Yeah. I mentioned that in America, The Office, well, got off to a slow start. You just repeated that because the critics didn't particularly care for it, and I don't think they knew where they were going. And it was a groundbreaking show, which we'll talk about and why that was. But for instance, in that first series of, I think, six episodes, it was a short season for them that first year. The woman playing Meredith, Kate Flannery, kept her waitress job during the run of the show. There was another character who worked for Merrill Lynch as a broker. He called clients during the filming of the show because he was keeping his day job. He didn't know that this was going to happen. Dana Stevens, writing in Slate at the time, said for that those still mourning for the BBC series, seeing the roles already recast with American actors is like walking up to find your beloved has been abducted and replaced by a random stranger. They didn't think this was going to make it, this show, and eventually it would become the most popular show on NBC. How did it turn the corner?
I think a huge part of it was they had to find the heart of Michael Scott. In the first season, you see him being mean to his employees. In the pilot, he mock fires Pam, and she's sobbing, and he's laughing at her. And you really hate him in that moment. And they had to fix that. And in the summer before season two, a film opened up in theaters that changed everything, which is the 40-year-old version. And the writers saw that movie, and they saw Steve Carell. He played a lonely, sad, and sort of pathetic man, but he was so warm and so lovable that you cared about him deeply. And they wanted to bring that sense of vulnerability to Michael Scott. So in season two, they really started to explain him and explain his desperate need for family and friends and just his deep-seated loneliness. And when you understood that about him, you forgave all of his sins, and you realized it's a lonely man who is acting out of desperate need for human connection.
That's kind of a
And
right-hand turn from where the British series was. Did the writers here and the producers here in America have free range once they bought the rights? Could they
yeah.
do whatever they wanted, or did Ricky Gervais have to sign off on it?
They had free rein. Gervais is very smart. He said the show only works if you guys run it. I've done my show. This is your show. I trust you. Just go with it.
We're going to go into a break right now, and we'll come back with more of our conversation with Andy Green, senior writer at Rolling Stone and the author of The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. But first, let's go out with a jingle, shall we? It's radio. This is a Dunder Mifflin jingle written and performed by the staff of Dunder Mifflin in The Office from several years ago.
Out of paper, out of stock. There's friendly faces around the block. Break loose from the chains that are causing you pain. Call Michael and Stanley, Jim Dwight Creed. Call Andy and Kelly for your business paper needs. Dunder Mifflin,
the people person's paper people.
Dunder Mifflin,
the people person's
time,
paper
time out,
people.
Time out, time out, time out, time out. I thought I was under the impression that this was going to be a wrap.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins.
Attention, all Dunder Mifflin employees, please. We have a meeting in the conference room.
We're in the office this hour with Andy Green, senior writer at Rolling Stone and author of The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. We asked listeners to give some of their favorite episodes and moments from the show. John on Facebook chose Scott's Tots from season 6 when we learned that years ago, Michael promised a group of underprivileged children that he would pay for them to go to college if they stayed in school. Well, they did. And now they're high school seniors, and it's time for Michael to break the news to them.
My dream was in the right place.
You owe this to us.
Okay, hold on. Hold on. Now, I can't pay for your college, but you don't have to go to class to be in class. Online courses are a viable option to a traditional college experience. And the best way to access those courses is with your own personal laptop, which is rendered useless without batteries, and I have one for each of you. Hold on, they're lithium.
A scene from Scott's Tots from season 6 of The Office. Robert on Twitter said his favorite was Dwight's speech from season 2 when Dwight wins a Salesman of the Year award, but develops crippling stage fright when he learns he has to give a speech. Jim figures he would help by giving Dwight some pointers from great speakers throughout history, which turns out to be a speech by Benito Mussolini.
Blood alone moves the wheels of history! Have you ever asked yourselves in an hour of meditation, which everyone finds during the day, how long we have been striving for greatness? Not only the years we've been at war, the war of work, but from the moment, as a child, when we realized that the world could be conquered.
Dwight's speech from season 2 of The Office. We're here with Rolling Stone senior writer Andy Green, whose oral history of the show was released in March and debuted as a New York Times bestseller. After its 9-year run on NBC, they sold the rights to Netflix, and they are the ones that really have allowed this show to become the massive hit that it is. What is it about this show? It's an old show. It's not new material. People have seen this.
Yeah, I think it's comfort food in a difficult time, and I think it's something that you can relate to, that you watch most sitcoms, and that's not your life. It's a laugh track, it's music cues, it feels so phony, where everybody has a boss that drives them crazy, and a coworker that they don't get along with. You feel like you're Jim as you watch The Office. You feel like this is your life in a strange way, and there's just so much about it that feels real, as goofy as the show is. I think people everywhere in every culture, they can tap in to that reality. And it's just so darn funny. And to binge it on Netflix and just watch hours of it in a row, you just vanish into the world of Dunder Mifflin and paper. And it's just a great vacation.
And it found a new audience, because a lot of people watching it on Netflix were in diapers or weren't born when this thing was on television, real television.
Right.
And they're not going to experience, many of them, that environment, because a lot of these younger people are gig workers. They're not sitting at a desk 8 hours a day in an office with strangers that they have to get along with. They don't have to put up with the mundaneness of it all. And I'm told by one critic, Allison Herman, who writes for The Ringer, she says there's nothing more hilarious to a digital nomad, these millennials and Gen Zers, I guess, than a meeting that should have been an email. So they're seeing it through a different lens, and it's still funny.
Yeah, and if you watch the show now, it's sort of a time capsule of a different era. That it's really pre-social media in so many ways. When the show started, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook. The cast talked to their fans on MySpace. It's sort of a look at a culture that's kind of fading in the world of Zoom and whatnot.
There have been other shows since The Office that they've broken the fourth wall and allowed the characters to talk to the camera and were kind of mockumentaries as well. Had this not started in Britain using that format, would this have occurred? A, would it have occurred to shoot this show like a mockumentary to any producer or director out there? And B, would it have occurred to anybody to do a show about a paper company and the people who are stuck in this room all day with each other?
Yeah, I think without Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant that there wouldn't be a show about a paper company, because the premise is just so absurdly boring sounded. But I think the temptation to do a mockumentary on TV was very desirable because it's so cheap. It's just one set, it's two cameras, there's no studio audience, there's no fancy set. And there's no fancy lighting cues or anything. It's just a much easier, faster way to work.
And I'm glad you brought up the fact that the camera people were hired from Survivor, because that was one of the original reality shows. And they do have a way of shooting and editing that show that makes it all appear to be dramatic and spontaneous. And I'm curious, because The Office looks spontaneous. There are moments in The Office where there's a sudden jerk of the camera or a quick zoom into somebody on the camera, because it looks like the characters are doing something spontaneous, completely unplanned. Mm-hmm. Did the camera people know what was going to happen in those scenes, or were they told, zoom in quickly, jerk here, move quickly over here, or did they have to react in the moment?
They knew, broadly speaking, but they didn't watch rehearsals because they wanted to tap into the same instincts that they used on Survivor, where you have one shot to capture this. You don't know who's going to do what, and you go herky-jerky. You do a quick zoom in on somebody if something dramatic is happening. And they always tried to think in the mind of the unseen filmmaker and present the show through him. And so they wanted it to really feel like Survivor, where they didn't know. And they kind of knew, but they pretended that they didn't know.
Yeah. and you mentioned that they shot it with no special lighting. They're in this one, pretty much always in this one room, this office with some side rooms, a conference room, Michael Scott's office and places like that. But they didn't dress it up. They didn't have a laugh track. They didn't make it look pretty. Normal sitcoms would have made it look ridiculously pretty.
Yeah.
And this is on NBC at a time when they were coming off Friends and other shows where these friends in New York City were living in this enormous apartment that no one could possibly afford at that age, doing what they did as their side jobs.
Right.
How did NBC allow this, first of all, and how did the producers stick to their guns on this?
It was a real challenge because they shot the show everywhere. They tried Fox and CBS and even HBO. It was no, 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 or they said maybe, but we want a laugh track and we want beautiful young people and we don't want it to be paper, you know. But they really stuck to their guns, and NBC was sort of in a weird place because Frasier and Friends were both ending, and so was Will and Grace was dying out, and so was ER was really past its prime, and they needed something new. And they just took a chance on the show and gave it six. But it was a real reach, and it was so different than everything else that Jeff Zucker, who was running NBC at the time, he was very unsure about it because they wanted a new Friends. And they tried to launch a new Friends that season. They launched Joey as a Friends spinoff, and that was their big hope. And The Office was seen as a small show that didn't really have a lot of hope attached to it.
Wow. They changed a lot of things in the American version. They changed all the names in the American version. In Britain, the company is called Warner Hogg. It, too, is a paper company. This is Dunder Mifflin. And that name, Dunder Mifflin, sounds exactly like what The Office turns out to be. Inept. Uh-huh. They set the show in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Now, I've been to Scranton. And this show may be the only thing that Scranton has to recommend it.
Oh.
I'm sorry about that. And then you have the romantic leads, Pam and Jim. Jim Halpert and Pam Beasley. Really ordinary sounding names. But all of this sounds kind of genius when you come right down to it. And you say that the writers would agonize over every weekly script. Did they agonize over the names of these characters too?
They changed it. It was first Jim Nelson and then changed to Jim Halpert, but I don't think that they really agonized much on the names.
Okay. And you write from the very beginning that they wanted unknowns to play these characters.
Yes.
And you start at the very beginning of the series coming together with the auditions for the actors. Why were they searching for unknowns?
Because they wanted it to feel real. They didn't want viewers to be taken out of the world by seeing a famous face. So they wanted it. They wanted the illusion of an actual documentary, and they had big names try out. That Seth Rogen and Patton Oswalt, they both auditioned to be Dwight, and they gave it to an actor that's named Rainn Wilson, who's much more obscure.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and for Michael Scott, they auditioned hundreds of people and tons of big names.
Paul Rudd, Steve Zahn, Colin Hanks, Josh Radnor, just a few who auditioned for Michael Scott. And then they were considering, I'm told, you write, Eugene Levy, or Levy, mm-hmm. Cedric the Entertainer, which is astounding to me, Dan Aykroyd, Matthew Broderick, and, wait for it, Stephen Colbert.
Yep.
And yet they settled on Steve Carell, who was well-known because he was on The Daily Show with Jon
right.
Stewart.
So he was the most famous one, but he was just a former correspondent on The Daily Show, where there was tons of them. Mm-hmm. And so, but they offered it to Paul Giamatti and to Philip Seymour Hoffman, and then they both turned it down because they were movie stars. And back then, it was seen as a huge step down to do TV if you were a movie star. And that's changed now. And then Bob Odenkirk was really close to being Michael Scott. He went through several rounds, and they were almost hiring him when they got cold feet.
Wow. You write about Jenna, who plays Pam, Jenna Fisher, who plays Pam. She was a struggling actress at the time who had been a receptionist. And you have a little story about her audition, and Jim Krasinski, John Krasinski, who plays Jim, came into the audition, and they broke for lunch, and he sat down next to this guy, and he had some things to say that under normal circumstances would probably get you disqualified for being in the show. Talk about that.
Yeah, this was like John Krasinski. He was a recent Brown graduate working as a waiter in New York City, struggling to find small roles. And he went to the audition, and he sat down, and he starts talking to this guy who was eating a salad, and he goes, "Yeah, I think this is a pretty bad idea. I can't imagine that show is going to work." And he's speaking with Greg Daniels, who's the showrunner of The Office, that's responsible, you know, who was casting the show essentially, and that was his future boss, and he was still hired.
And Pam was asked, I'm told, in the audition, somebody sitting on the other side of the table said, "Does Pam like being a receptionist?" And she just said no, and nothing else. And there was a silence in the room, and everybody started to laugh.
Yeah, it was a very bold decision to just get in the character of Pam, who has no interest in talking to a camera crew. She's just trying to do her job. So they said to her, and as you say, do you like being a receptionist? And the most people, they gave long answers to show their acting chops. But she just went, no. And she used silence. And silence is a key thing on The Office. It's so different than most sitcoms. And they let moments sit there and linger, and the tension just would build, and there'd be no music. And that's so different than like how Friends or something would do a joke.
You know, Steve Carell's Michael Scott and Ricky Gervais' David Brent, the two leads in both versions of The Office, walked a very fine human resources violation line even then. Some of the words that came out of their mouths, some of the things that they do would make you cringe, your skin would crawl. I've worked for people like that, so it was very familiar. But some of their comments and observations and actions would get them fired in today's world, and yet the show is more popular today than it ever was. In this Me Too world in which we live, and this litigious world in which we live, why? Why do they get away with it even on TV? We find it funny.
Yeah, it's because you love the character. Because you know that Michael Scott, that he's just acting out, that you know his heart is good. So you forgive his sexist comments, or even his racist comments, his fat-shaming comments. because you realize it's a man playing to the cameras, trying to be funny, failing, but his heart is in the right place in some strange way. So we forgive it.
Yeah. We've talked about how the British version, the Michael Scott in the British version, David Brent, was edgier and mean, and there were soft, gushy feelings about Steve Carell, at least after the first episode, the pilot episode. But what really, I'm told, changed his character and made the audience fall in love with him was season 2, episode 3, the Staff Office Olympics. What changed there in his character?
Yeah, it's a very rough time in his character's life. He's trying to move. It's not working out. He has no luck in his love life. But at the end, he comes back to the office after trying to buy a condo, and they give him a medal that's just a yogurt lid that's in an Office Olympics. And it's meant as a joke. Mm-hmm. But he's so desperate for any validation and any recognition that he takes it. And Steve Carell, in that moment, he teared up and looked so grateful and so emotional that you felt for him. And it was one of the first moments where you see just this pulsating vulnerability. Wow. That would really grow as the season went on.
So from season 3, the episode called The Merger, we're going to play a little tune that Michael used in that episode to welcome the new transfers to the Scranton branch of Dunder Mifflin with a song that tells them everything they need to know about their new hometown, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Here's Steve Carell as Michael Scott.
Sitting in my office with a plate of grilled bacon. Call my man twice just to see what was shaking.
Yo, Mike, our town is dope and pretty.
So check out how we live.
In the Electric City.
They call it Scranton.
What?
The Electric City. Scranton.
What?
The Electric City. Lazy Scranton, the Electric City. They call it that because of the electricity. The city's laid out from east to west, and our public parks and libraries are truly the best. Call poison control if you're bit by a spider.
But check that it's covered by your healthcare provider.
Plenty of space in the parking lot.
But the little cars go in the compact spot.
Spot, 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 spot. Snack attack time.
Don't lose your head.
We like Cugino's for the tasty bread. They call it Scranton.
What?
The Electric City.
Scranton. What?
The Electric City.
Scranton.
What? The Electric City.
Scranton.
What? The Electric City.
Scranton.
What?
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Andy Green, senior writer for Rolling Stone, is our guest. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. We've been talking about the tremendous amount of heart this show had, and you see it in one of our listeners' favorite episodes, which is also one of your favorites, Andy, Season 3's Business School. Before we get to the sweet moment from that episode, how about a typical Michael Scott moment? In the episode, Ryan invites Michael to speak to his grad school business class. Michael thinks he's there to share his business expertise. In reality, it's only so Ryan can get extra credit.
And now, without further ado, I present the regional manager of Dunder Mifflin Scranton, Michael Scott.
Hello, everyone. I am Michael Scott.
Hello, I'm Brandon Hidalgo, CEO of the teaching company.
And I'd like to start today by inspiring you. May I borrow someone's textbook, please? Thank you. What have we here? Ooh, economics. Very, very interesting. You cannot learn from books. Replace these pages with life lessons, and then you will have a book that is worth its weight in gold. I know these are expensive, but the lesson is priceless. Good.
Now, for the example of the show's heart is the scene where Michael shows up to Pam's art show. Only one other person from The Office, Oscar, was at that show. And all he and his partner did was critique her work. But then along comes Michael.
My God, these could be tracings. Oh, look at this one. Wow. You nailed it. How much?
What do you mean?
I don't see a price.
You want to buy it?
Well, yeah. Yeah, we have to have it for the office. I mean, there's my window and there's my car. Is that your car?
Uh-huh.
That is our building. And we sell paper. I'm really proud of you.
Michael buys that piece. He hangs it in his office. And that's an example, I think, of something that is rare in sitcoms. There is an incredible sweetness to that and to his character.
Yeah, and you see his real love for her and love and just love of the job and even the building, that he takes such pride in it and he's being so sincere, and she's so in need in that moment because nobody came to her show. It was like not even Jim came. Yeah. You know, and she's shattered, and that's sort of a big moment in their bond together, which sort of grew as the series went on. And the final Michael Scott scene is them hugging it at the airport, and it's just so incredibly sweet. And the final shot of the entire show is her drawing of the building.
It's achingly sad in a way, yeah, for a comedy, and that's really, I don't want to say dangerous, but it seems out of character for a sitcom. Is that one of the elements that they discovered is really going to make this thing connect?
I think yes, because most of the characters, because even the winners on the show are still working at an office that they don't really like going to. They don't have a great job. They're sort of living a life of just incredible need. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, they can relate to that.
You like Michael, and Pam comes to like Michael. In fact, you use the word love.
Yeah.
Despite all of the negatives in his personality and the desperation that leads him to act the way he acts, but there's still this incredible uncomfortableness when you watch him in many situations, and there's plenty of that in the season 4 episode Dinner Party. It's one of your favorites, Andy, and one of our listeners, Duncan, on Facebook, highlighted the scene where Dwight crashes the party, setting off a fight between Michael and his on-again, off-again girlfriend, Jan.
You said that I could not invite Dwight because he was not part of a couple and because we didn't have enough wine glasses. Dwight brought glasses and a person.
Fine, so, whatever you want, just like always, whatever you want.
Whatever I want, it's never whatever I want.
It's fine.
When I wanted to see Stomp and you wanted to see Wicked, what did we see?
We saw
When I said that I wanted to have kids and you said that you wanted me to have a vasectomy, what did I do? And then, when you said that you might want to have kids and I wasn't so sure, who had the vasectomy reversed? And then when you said you definitely didn't want to have kids, who had it reversed back? Snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. I did.
Okay.
You have no idea the physical toll the 3 vasectomies have on a person.
Wow.
Not the stuff of sitcoms. He's wonderful, but she... with very few lines, is supremely wonderful.
She is, which I just love Laura Harden, who played Jan. She was a genius. And that scene, that shows Steve Carell's, just his range, because they tried that a few different takes, and it was too intense. It was too hard to watch. So when they did the last take, he thought on the fly of that snip, snap, snip, snap thing, which sort of lightened it a bit. And they used it.
Talk to me about Dwight Schrute.
The
assistant to the regional manager. Talk to me about him. Where did that character come from? Was he in the British series too?
He was called Gareth on the British series, but he was very different. The Gareth, that character was a very tiny man who was obsessed with the army and like killing people. And he was funny. But they took it to a very different place on The Office, and they made the character, which in a lot of ways is the least grounded character on the show. Mm-hmm. And he's this wild mass of contradictions. He's a quasi-Amish beet farmer that loves Star Trek, and he loves heavy metal. He's a huge nerd, but he also attracts beautiful women. He's all of these weird opposite things about him that somehow felt as to be one character in a strange way.
And his relationship with Jim Halpert is central to this show. Their combativeness, their one-upsmanship throughout the series.
Yes, it was constant pranks, constant war. But the thing I love is that they're the two best salesmen. And when they team up on a sales call, that they're an amazing duo. It's a seamless team that mm-hmm. they can summon and sell paper and be awesome at it. That they're pros.
And you mentioned that Dwight attracts beautiful women. And ultimately, he falls for, and she falls for him, Angela, who's another worker in the office. They seemed odd individually and very different and yet destined for each other. Angela's very rigid, let's put it that way.
She's very rigid, but they both love order. They both love discipline. They both take their work very seriously, and there's a real chemistry between them that lasted all 9 seasons of the show.
Yeah. In the course of writing this book, it's a conversation with a lot of different people. You talk to everybody who was involved in this series. And you even talked to the guy who handled the boom mic for the series.
Yes.
Nobody talks to the guy handling the boom mic.
No,
for the
but that's Brian Whittle, who was an amazing source because he was 1 foot away from every take of every single scene that they ever shot. So he's just a fire hose of stories.
It makes you wonder why people don't talk to those people. When did you learn to talk to those people? This is not the first time you've done this. When did you learn to talk to the people behind the scenes who we would never even think of and don't even know they're there?
No, it's through my job at Rolling Stone, where I discovered talking to a band's drummer is often better than the lead singer because no one talks to them and they're happy to talk and they have stories. Mm-hmm. Or the engineer on an album, that people who were there but aren't the central figure, that they are often more interesting than the central figure.
What kind of stuff did you get from the boom mic operator and some of the other people behind the scenes that we would never even think of?
It was the boom mic operator who first told me that Steve Carell, that he wasn't offered a new contract to come back, you know, which is the real reason why he left. I heard from several sources. But he had funny stories about just moments on set when they couldn't stop laughing, or just there's endless stories. I quote him constantly in the book.
Yeah, people don't understand how long it takes to film a 30-minute television show. It takes hours, days, and these people would be cooped up on this set in this office. Was it actually in an office, or did they build a set on a soundstage?
In the first season, it was an actual office that they dressed up. It was the office used by J.J. Abrams in the 90s when he was making Felicity. It was his very office. And when they got picked up, they built it on a Van Nuys soundstage.
But they have to be on this set all day while they do all these different takes and different scenes. And you say that they ended up playing solitaire on the computers and surfing the internet and things like that, which is exactly what you see the characters doing because they're so bored in the office, which gave it authenticity.
Yeah, it's a very different shooting format. On most sitcoms, you film your scenes, and when you're done, you just go to your dressing room, and you might wait about 6 hours until they need you again.
Right.
On The Office, they sat there just all day and just pretended to do work to be in the background of shots.
I want to go back to this Michael Scott thing that you learned from the boom operator, because I always assumed that Michael Scott left the show because his movie career was beginning to really take off, and why waste so much time shooting a sitcom, which takes your whole life away from you, when you can just go to a movie and shoot a movie in 3 months and be done for the next 3 years.
Right.
But no, NBC decided not to renew the contract of the lead guy on their lead series. What's up with that?
Well, what happened was that Comcast bought NBC, and Jeff Zucker left as the head, and Bob Greenblatt, he took over. And NBC then, they were in a distant fourth place, that they had Parks and Rec and 30 Rock and The Office and Community, which are these beloved sitcoms that the critics love, but the ratings were a tiny fraction of what they had in the days of Seinfeld and Friends and Frasier. So Bob Greenblatt, as the new head, he really wanted to sort of to go back to the era of must-see TV, and he wanted to be done with these shows. And so to offer Steve Carell a big, fat new contract, it didn't make sense to him.
So he wanted to be done with the most successful comedy of the bunch.
Yes, but it was successful in relative terms. Okay. It was the biggest sitcom on the fourth place network.
You see, evidently Bob Greenblatt should have been Michael Scott, because his decisions are as stupid as Michael Scott's. the departure of Michael Scott, Steve Carell, led to a frantic behind-the-scenes effort, evidently, to find a replacement. And people were struggling with whether he should be replaced by somebody in the office, already working there. Should they promote somebody, or should it be from somebody outside? And I remember rooting for Dwight, because Dwight was always the guy who wanted to be the boss, always self-promoting himself. But they gave it to the Ed Helms character. Why?
It was after a very long debate, and the writers were very torn, and a bunch of the writers, they wanted Dwight. But what happened was that Ed Helms had become a big movie star in the past few years, that the Hangover series was humongous, that those movies were blockbuster hits. And NBC, they wanted a big name star. So they went with Andy, and it was a big mistake.
And they also brought in some extras later on, like James Spader came in, and I never could figure out why he was there. Kathy Bates came in for a while, which I thought was an odd choice, and it kind of didn't work. You know, Steve Carell had a movie career during the show, but he went on to have an even bigger one when he left. John Krasinski has directed things now, and he's on the Jack Ryan series on Netflix, playing a very different character. Ed Helms has done films. What happened to the rest of these people? Where are they now?
Well, they mostly still work, but if you're in a sitcom that's successful, it's hard to not be typecast. Yeah. It's hard not to be seen forever as like Gilligan or as like Greg Brady, that these characters, they can define you in people's minds, and you go into audition for a new show and they love seeing you, but they don't want to bring you onto their new project because your face is that character to people. So it can be tough.
And because it's so successful in its post-network life, they're still out there as those characters, which makes it difficult to work. They're getting residuals, but still, that's not the same as finding something productive. Jenna Fisher, who played Pam, and Angela Kinsey, who played Angela on the show, do a podcast together about the show.
It's fantastic, yeah.
And both of them have said that they're in touch with everybody who was ever involved in the show, the writers, the producers, all of the actors, the extras who came and went, etc. And I think it was Angela who said that none of them have ever been spoken to about the possibility of a reboot on this series, because other shows like Will and Grace have gotten a reboot. Why do you suppose that is?
I think that they would need Greg Daniels, who's very busy on a new Netflix show. And I think they proved if you don't have Steve Carell, it's a pretty tough sell for an audience. And it's just too many people who've been too successful. You need Mindy Kaling. You need all these people who have their own careers now who would not want to come back. And I think most reboots proved you can't go home again.
Andy Green has been our guest, senior writer at Rolling Stone and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.